Look more drums.
Welcome to Midpoint Monday on 88.5 FM and WMNF.org. I'm Sean Canaan. Happy Indigenous Peoples Day. And thank you to everyone who donated during this show last week. And if you'd like to contribute to independent media, you can do this at WMNF.org. Today, we're going to bring you several important topics on Midpoint. Later on in the show, we'll listen in on some of the opening statements from today's confirmation hearings for U.S. Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett. And we'll hear later about a march for reparations that's coming up this weekend in St. Petersburg. And also, there's only a few days left for the public to weigh in on three proposed toll highways through rural parts of Florida. And we'll hear how you can tell the Florida Department of Transportation what you think about that. So our first topic, this Saturday, the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is holding what it's calling a march for reparations to African people. In a press release, the group says the intention of the march is to build unity with the African community's demand for reparations for slavery, genocide, and colonial terror that continues to this day in the form of police murder, mass incarceration, and economic and healthcare disparities. So to find out more about the March for Reparations that's coming up on Saturday, I spoke recently with Jesse Neville. He's national chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Jesse's also a former candidate for St. Petersburg mayor.
Jesse, welcome to WMNF. Tell us about the March for Reparations. When is it and why are you doing it?
Thank you, Sean. I'm glad to be here. The March for Reparations to African People is happening on October 17th of this year. And it's a national day of political action that the Uhuru Solidarity Movement is coordinating to call upon white people in particular to come out and take a stand of principled solidarity with the black community and their struggle for power and self-determination over their lives. It's going to be happening in six cities throughout the U.S., including right here in St. Petersburg, Florida, and as well as in California, Oregon, St. Louis, Missouri, and other places throughout the country.
So why not just join the daily Black Lives Matter demonstrations that are happening in St. Petersburg? Why are you having a separate march for reparations?
Well, we believe that it is important that people are out demonstrating every single day here in St. Petersburg. And, you know, of course, we absolutely salute the incredible and heroic uprisings of the black community that occurred in this country after the brutal murder of George Floyd and many others after him in the last few months. And the reason why this particular March for Reparations to African People is different is because it's based on a call that has been made by the leadership of the African working class, the African People's Socialist Party, and Chairman Omali Yeshitela, who leads the Uhuru Movement, who has specifically made a call to us as the white population that we have to go beyond protest, that protesting is good, but we have to get organized under the leadership of the African working class and take an ongoing principled stand for reparations to African people. And that's what the March for Reparations to African People is about. So it is a march, but it's more than just a march. It's a call to become organized and build a movement for reparations to African people under the leadership of the African Liberation Movement.
Where in St. Petersburg will the march be, and what do you think it'll look like?
The march is going to start at St. Petersburg City Hall, which is at 175 5th Street North. And it's going to be about 3 miles of a march towards Vinoy Park. And the march will include speakers from the African People's Socialist Party. And actually, Chairman Omali Yeshitela will be speaking, as well as Akile Anai, who ran for city council last year and in 2017 on a platform of reparations. Akile will be speaking, as well as other community leaders, on the question of reparations to the black community. And we will also be raising up the demand that the Uhuru Movement has put forward over the years for the 85 acres beneath the Tropicana Field baseball stadium to be returned to the black community for use of economic development and affordable housing as a concrete act of reparations to African people that the city of St. Petersburg has a responsibility to carry out.
Why do you think that the area underneath the Tropicana Field Stadium and the parking lots and so forth, why do you think that that should be returned to the Black community?
That's a good question, and it's based on the history of the Tropicana Field, which was actually created in the early 90s after St. Petersburg City Council voted to displace a very old Black neighborhood that was known as the Gas Plant District, where there were hundreds of families and almost 100 Black businesses that resided in that area. And the city of St. Petersburg lied to the Black community and promised light industry and job opportunities in return for displacing people from their homes. And instead, in the 20 years since that happened, there has been no economic development for the Black community in this city. The conditions faced by the Black population on the South Side have only intensified. The gap between what we experience as white people and the wealth that's been poured into downtown and the stark poverty and, you know, disparities, whether it's in education, whether it's in police violence, whether it's in infant and maternal mortality, are some of the worst in the whole country here in St. Petersburg. And that Tropicana Field baseball stadium is a monument to that legacy of anti-Black oppression and gentrification and displacement upon which the entire political economy of the city of St. Petersburg rests. So this is a really important demand that the Black liberation movement in this city has put forward for many years. Right now, there's all this discussion about what the city of St. Pete is going to do with that land. And they're talking about developing office buildings or putting a shopping center or doing something else and making some kind of a superficial nod to what used to be there by renaming it the Gas Plant District. And that is a complete insult. What the Uhuru movement is calling for is that this represents an opportunity to right a historic wrong by turning that land over to the Black community as a form of reparations. And the Uhuru movement, under the campaign of Akile last year, actually developed a proposal called the Reparations Land Trust Authority for what a democratic body would look like that would have possession of that land and be responsible for genuine development in the interests of the Black community. So this is something that white people should get behind, and this is one of the demands of the March for Reparations, as well as the larger demand nationally of the entire campaign, which is a demand for Wall Street and the banks and corporations in this country to pay reparations to African people through funding the Black Power Blueprint Project that the Uhuru Movement has created in St. Louis, which is a similar kind of anti-colonial economic development initiative. And we're making a call to Wall Street and to the banks because, like the city of St. Petersburg, Wall Street is built on the history and the legacy of the enslavement and the oppression of Black people in this country.
Well, Jesse Neville, with the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, is there anything else about the March for Reparations that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would just encourage people to go to uhurusolidarity.org/march. If you go specifically to St. Pete March for Reparations.eventbrite.com, you can find more specific information about the march that's going to be happening in the city of St. Petersburg. On Saturday, October 17th at 11 a.m., the march will begin at St. Pete City Hall. And anyone in this city who wants to see an end to the incessant police murder and terror against the Black community, not only in St. Petersburg, but throughout the country, should come out and join us and march for reparations to African people.
Jesse Neville with the Uhuru Solidarity Movement, thanks so much for coming on WMNF today.
Thank you.
That was Jesse Neville. He's national chair of the Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Their March for Reparations to African People is this Saturday in St. Petersburg, beginning at 11 in the morning. It'll start in front of St. Pete City Hall. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:15 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm the host of Midpoint Monday. And later on in the show, we're going to hear some of the senator's opening statements from today's Amy Coney Barrett Supreme Court nomination hearings. Confirmation hearings, that is. And if you'd like to weigh in on anything you hear during the show, I'm going to give out the phone number right now. The number is 813-239-9663. You can also text 813-433-0885 or email dj@wmnf.org. Well, before we get to the Supreme Court confirmation hearings, we are going to hear about a road project. The state is considering building three major toll highways through rural parts of West Florida. The projects are part of what are called MCORs, and the draft final reports were recently released, and the state DOT is taking public comment until this Wednesday. We're going to post links to the reports and how you can comment. That'll be on our website, WMNF.org, later this afternoon. But for more on these proposed toll highways, I spoke a few days ago with Lindsay Cross. She's Government Relations Director with Florida Conservation Voters.
Well, welcome to WMNF, Lindsay Cross with Florida Conservation Voters. Why don't you tell our listeners about where MCORs stands, what it is, and what type of input they're looking for right now?
MCORs, which stands for the Multi-Use Corridors of Regional and Economic Significance, is a massive infrastructure project that's been going on for a little over a year. It was first came to being through a piece of legislation in 2019, which was Senate Bill 7068, which was voted on. It was a very rushed bill that went through at the end of session. The governor signed it into law in May of 2019, and it started a very aggressive, approximately 15-month process to evaluate the need and the potential impacts of building up to 330 new miles of toll roads throughout our state, some of them in our most natural and rural communities. So it's something that organizations and businesses and really Floridians across the state have been concerned about since they learned about this legislation last year. So DOT, through its kind of its mandate in the Senate bill, has been hosting a series of task force meetings. Those task forces are made up of roughly 40 individuals representing different organizations, whether that's special interests like the trucking industry. There's a lot of state agencies that are represented, such as the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission or Department of Education. There's also a handful of environmental nonprofits that sit on those groups. They have been meeting for more than a year now. The process started in August of 2019 with a joint task force meeting that was held at the Tampa Convention Center. And we are getting ready for the final round of MCORs meeting, which will be in just about 2 weeks. And DOT is again proposing to have in-person meetings in Tampa as the final round, which will be number 9 for the task force meetings. So throughout this process, the task force members have been tasked, first of all, with evaluating the need for these roads, which is something that they have not been able to do because there is not a need for all of this new asphalt and the associated development that will come with it. The task force has been required to help develop some guiding principles that will guide the way this road planning process goes forward. And DOT has been collating those comments and that input. And now we're at the process where they have a draft final report for each of the three task forces. So for those who are not familiar with kind of the location of these, there's three different corridors that are under study, under review, essentially. In the southern part of the state, there's one called the Southwest Central Connector, which goes from Collier up to Polk County. So that's an 8-county area. There's one which is the Suncoast Connector, which goes from Citrus County up to Jefferson County and could eventually go up into the Georgia border. That one is a 7-county area, and then a small piece in between is called the Northern Turnpike Connector, and that's a 4-county area, which is meant to connect our existing Florida Turnpike with the Suncoast Parkway, which is a toll road in Citrus County right now. So there are draft reports for each three of the task forces that DOT, Department of Transportation, published on their website on September 29th. It triggered a 15-day public comment period, which will end on October 14th. So that means for members of the public who are interested and concerned about this process, we really only have about a week left to comment on those reports, which are about 40 pages each.
And the southernmost proposed toll highway that you're talking about, that cuts right through Florida panther habitat. What do environmentalists say about the impact on Florida panthers if that road is built?
Absolutely. So each of the roads are going to have serious implications for our water, our wildlife, our rural communities, agriculture, which is the number two industry in our state. Within the different study corridors, there's some things that are unique or more pressing concerns for each of those corridors. So in the Southwest Central area, certainly it is the Florida panther habitat. And some of these roads could go through primary or secondary panther habitat. There was recently a report that was commissioned by the Nature Conservancy with a panther biologist named Randy Kautz, who had really just some pretty sobering things to say about how detrimental these type of roads and the development that occurs because of them, that's really incentivized when you put new transportation corridors in, that this really could be the end of the Florida panther. There has been significant efforts over the past couple decades to improve protections for the panther. And we've actually seen that panthers have increased in their number and even have some great results that some of the female Florida panthers are making their way north of the Caloosahatchee River, which was previously kind of a barrier to expansion within the state. So it's so really affirming that we're seeing that potential expansion of the Florida panther habitat. But if these roads are built, then we know that roads fragment habitat, collisions with automobiles is the number one cause of mortality for the Florida panther. So if we really care about protecting our state animal, then we can't be for these roads.
Our guest is Lindsay Cross, Government Relations Director with Florida Conservation Voters, and this is WMNF in Tampa. And we're talking about the MCORs, the proposed toll highways, three of them through the west part of Florida in rural areas predominantly. In these draft final reports that have come out, these draft reports, one of the things that is there is something called a no-build option, which is the idea that maybe these roads aren't even needed in the first mm-hmm. place and that the state shouldn't build them. How important is it that the no-build option is in these draft reports?
It's critical that no-build is part of these reports. Florida Conservation Voters is one of the founding members of a coalition called the No Roads to Ruin Coalition, which includes, I believe, 99 organizations and businesses around the state. So if you're part of a group that wants to be our 100th member, we would love to welcome you in this final stage. But the no build, that idea of that is something that we have been pushing heavily throughout the entire process. DOT has a kind of a long, long kind of tried and true way of planning for new transportation. Usually transportation projects happen at the local, at the community level. They may come from local governments that are working through a metropolitan planning organization or kind of a regional body that's looking at what the transportation needs are for that area and then working in coordination with Department of Transportation to examine how those can be best studied, the need for them, and then how they can be constructed and operated. So what's happened with the MCORS process is rather than this happening kind of from the bottom up, it is a very politically motivated issue, which came from our current Senate President, Bill Galvano, from the Bradenton area. And this was his big bill. And so I think DOT was just as surprised as anyone when they had this kind of massive mandate placed in their lap, because it is contrary to the way their normal planning processes work. Because there are so many investments we've already made in this process, hundreds of millions of dollars already, we think it's really a misuse of taxpayer dollars to be doing this type of work without having a demonstrated need for the project. And that's what the reports clearly acknowledge right now, is that the task forces were not able to meet their statutory charge, which was to first evaluate the need for the roads. And so we think, especially during a time where we have significant budget restraints due to the COVID-19 global and health economic crisis, that anything that's not a need and is not a priority needs to be put on the back burner. And those type of funds should be redirected to things that we know are critical issues facing our state. So the no build, we believe, is the only way to truly protect what Floridians care about, and that's our quality of life, which means having clean water, productive agriculture, investments in our local communities, but without the strings attached of having a new massive toll road.
We're speaking with Lindsay Cross, Government Relations Director with Florida Conservation Voters. And if the no-build option is the one that they decide to do, if they don't build these three giant toll highways through rural parts of Florida, how do the things that the supporters want happen? How do people evacuate during a hurricane? How do we get broadband access to rural communities and so forth if these don't happen?
Yeah, excellent question, Sean. So what's interesting about this legislation and the whole idea of MCORs is that it's meant to be very aspirational, that they talk about it not just being roads, that it's infrastructure, that it's broadband, that it's revitalization of rural communities. But what we know through studies that have been done by independent organizations is that those type of things that community members want, like broadband and investments in utilities like sewer or water quality improvements, those things can be done without building a new road, and they can be done more economically. Hurricane evacuation is something that, of course, is a very, you know, it kind of pulls at your emotions because it can bring up that fear in people, especially as we have another hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico right now that continues to be top of mind for us. Unfortunately, we don't have enough information about where new evacuation routes should be placed because the state has not done a comprehensive statewide evacuation plan in more than 10 years. So investments first need to happen in that statewide study. That is something that Governor DeSantis did put some money into for the budget this year. So we look to see what those results are first. But that's something that, again, is driven more by the news media and, you know, political motivations rather than documented need for it. The state's own emergency management website still says that the smartest thing to do is first to stay within your local area to evacuate close to home, or if you have a home that is, you know, built to hurricane standards, to shelter in place. So with a state of nearly 22 million people, we really couldn't build enough roads to get everyone out of the state. So I think that's the wrong message, that anytime there's a hurricane, that we all need to get out of the state. Of course, in some of our areas, there are needs for, especially in coastal and low-lying communities and in flood zones, people do need to evacuate, but putting in these new toll roads may not be the best way to address that.
So Lindsay Cross with Florida Conservation Voters, how do people get in touch with the Florida Department of Transportation if they'd like to weigh in on these draft reports about MCORs?
So the Department of Transportation has been taking comments on MCORs throughout the process. They have a portal on their website, and if you search for MCORs, you can find it. It's floridamcors.com. On their homepage right now is a link to their draft task force reports. And if you scroll down, you can open up each of the reports and go through them. There is a comment form which allows you to put either broad or specific comments. You could do it by page and line item if there are things you want to make specific comments on, or if you want to just make a broader statement about no build and reinvesting our taxpayer dollars. DOT, unfortunately, has made it more difficult for some of the advocacy organizations to allow people like an easy way to comment because of this form that you need to fill out one at a time. There are still petitions that are going around. Florida Conservation Voters has one, a letter that people can sign on to, which is available through our website, fcvoters.org/take-action. So there are opportunities to participate that way. And you can also send an email to DOT that's fdot.listens@dot.state.fl.us.
And the upcoming Tampa meetings, when are they and how can people get involved with those?
So the last round of task force meetings are going to be October 19th, 20th, and 21st. That's a Monday through a Wednesday. And I understand that they will be held in person in Tampa, but there will also be a virtual option. That will be the first in-person meeting the DOT has had since the pandemic started in March, and we think that it's still too soon to be holding in-person gatherings of that size. If you think about an 8-hour meeting with 100 people or more, that's not the best way to be protecting the health of our Floridians. So I will be participating virtually. I've been participating in the virtual webinars and the task force meetings. We really had asked DOT at the beginning of this transition to the virtual format to put a pause on these. The first couple rounds of the webinars were done really poorly. There was really low success rate for people who wanted to provide public comment, actually being able to have their 3 minutes to speak. It's kind of closed out some people who don't have the access to be on a webinar like that. So we really thought, what's the rush for this right now? There's been other things that have been put on hold, and we thought it was certainly appropriate that DOT do that as well. But there's been political pressure for them to continue with this and to have these final reports to the governor, the Speaker of the House, and the Senate President on November 15th.
And Lindsey Cross, is there anything else that people should know about these three proposed toll highways through rural parts of Florida that you'd like to leave our listeners?
Well, mostly if you don't care about the water or the wildlife or the agriculture, you probably care about your pocketbook. These toll roads, if they were constructed in their entirety, could cost around $26 billion, according to some estimates. A group called Florida Tax Watch, which is a nonpartisan kind of government watchdog group, did an evaluation just of the Suncoast connector and found that it's just not financially feasible. That same assessment has been made by other groups such as Cornell Consulting. And for any politician who claims to be fiscally conservative, they cannot be in support of this. We know that the roads do not pay for themselves. They will require significant investments from our state budget. They will also be siphoning money from the Florida Turnpike Enterprise System, which means that even if you don't live in one of these corridor areas, if you live in Orlando or South Florida and use toll roads there, your toll revenue will be going to help subsidize the construction of these roads, which are through some of our least populated communities and do not have the built-in need for them. So your taxpayer dollars will be impacted. This is pulling money away from other critical infrastructure projects. In this year's budget, the governor vetoed over $1 billion. There was over $90 million of transportation infrastructure and water quality improvements that were vetoed, but the MCOR's budget actually increased this year. So it is going to take money away from local priorities for something that does not have a demonstrated need.
Well, Lindsey Cross, the Government Relations Director with Florida Conservation Voters, thank you so much for coming on WMNF.
You're welcome, Sean. Thank you so much.
Well, that was Lindsey Cross with Florida Conservation Voters speaking about the public comment period ending this Wednesday for the draft final reports on the three proposed toll highways through rural Florida. FloridaMCORS.com is where you can read the draft reports and submit a comment. We'll also be linking to that on our website as well, WMNF.org. And I'd like to hear what you think about these proposed toll highways or any of today's other topics. The number to call in is 813-239-9663. You're listening to 88.5 FM WMNF Tampa. It's 12:34 in the afternoon. My name is Sean Canaan. I'm host of Midpoint Monday. You can text in 813-433-0885, or you can email dj@wmnf.org. So far we've talked about the March for Reparations that's happening this Saturday. You can call in about that, or you can talk about Florida MCORS. That's MCORES. So FloridaMCORS.com is their website. You can talk about those toll highways. Or our final topic, which is the big news of today, is Amy Coney Barrett's Supreme Court confirmation hearing that began this morning. And we'll take calls about that as well. You can call in now, or you can wait till after we hear from a couple of the senators. The Republican-led Senate is charging ahead to replace the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg with President Trump's pick before Election Day. Barring a dramatic development, Republicans appear to have the votes to confirm the 48-year-old conservative appellate judge to a lifetime seat on the Supreme Court. In prepared remarks for the Judiciary Committee hearing, Barrett says the courts cannot right every wrong. The hearing is like no other, with voting already underway in many states, including Florida, and the country is in the grips of a coronavirus pandemic. Two Republican senators on the panel have tested positive for the virus, and one of them, Senator Mike Lee, gave his opening statement this morning without a face covering. We have somebody on the line. Let's see if we can go right now to hear what one person says. Hi, caller. What's your name? Let me put you on the air. Caller, can you hear me? Hi, caller. What's your name and where are you calling from? I guess I can't put him on. All right, sorry. I'll get you in. We're going to come back in just a few minutes, caller, if you don't mind holding. Let's go. We're going to hear first from Senator Lindsey Graham. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Lindsey Graham is wielding the gavel in the performance of his political life. His Democratic opponent for Senate in South Carolina, Jamie Harrison, is reporting a record-breaking fundraising haul. 4 years ago, Lindsey Graham promised he would not support confirmation of a Supreme Court justice in an election year. But Lindsey Graham has flip-flopped and now says there will be a vote on Amy Coney Barrett in 10 days. So in a few minutes, we're going to hear from Democrat Dick Durbin. But here is Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's opening statement this morning.
Why are we here? Number one, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died on September the 18th. What can you say about Justice Ginsburg? She was confirmed 96-3. Now, those were days that have since passed. I regret that. 96-3. Now, this was a person who worked for the ACLU. Someone who was known in progressive circles as an icon. Apparently, just about every Republican voted for her. Her good friend on the court, Justice Scalia, I think got 97 votes. I don't know what happened between then and now. I guess we can all take some blame. But I just want to remind everybody there was a time in this country where someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg was seen by almost everybody as qualified for the position of being on the Supreme Court, understanding that she would have a different philosophy than many of the Republicans who voted for her. 27 years on the court, before becoming a member of the court, she was an active litigator, pushing for more equal justice and better rights for women throughout the country. Her close friend, until his death, Justice Scalia called her the leading and very successful litigator on behalf of women's rights, the Thurgood Marshall of that cause. What high praise. I can't say any more than that statement says. In my view, the person appearing before this committee is in a category of excellence, something the country should be proud of, and she will have a chance to make her case to be a worthy successor and to become the 9th member of the Supreme Court of the United States. On September the 26th, Judge Amy Barrett was nominated by President Trump to the Supreme Court. Who is she? She is a judge sitting on the 7th Judicial Circuit. She's highly respected. She was a professor at Notre Dame. 3 years during that tenure, she was chosen by the students to be the best professor, which I'm sure is no easy task at any college. She's widely admired for her integrity. She grew up in New Orleans. Graduated from Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee in 1994. Graduated summa cum laude and first in her class from Notre Dame Law School in 1997. So academically, she's very gifted. She clerked for Judge Lawrence Silberman on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, and then for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. She practiced law in Washington, D.C. She joined the faculty at Notre Dame in 2002. She's published numerous articles in prestigious journals, including the Columbia, University of Virginia, and Cornell Law Review. She's been a circuit court judge at the Seventh Circuit since 2017. She was confirmed to that position with a bipartisan vote. She has heard hundreds of cases in that capacity. She said, "I clerked for Justice Scalia more than 20 years ago, but the lessons I learned still resonate. His judicial philosophy is mine. A judge must apply the law as written. Judges are not policymakers, and they must be resolute in setting aside any policy views they might hold." She will give her statement, but I think that is a good summary of who she is. That's who Amy Barrett is in terms of the law. In terms of Amy Barrett, the individual, she and her husband have 7 children to adopt it. So 9 seems to be a good number. The process. This is an election year. We're confirming the judge in an election year after the voting has occurred. What will happen is that my Democratic colleagues will say, this has never been done, and they're right in this regard. No election year past July. The bottom line is Justice Ginsburg, when asked about this several years ago, said that a president serves for 4 years, not 3. There's nothing unconstitutional about this process. This is a vacancy that's occurred through a tragic loss of a great woman, and we're going to fill that vacancy with another great woman. The bottom line here is that this is doing its duty constitutionally. As to Judge Garland, the opening that occurred with the passing of Justice Scalia was in the early part of an election year. The primary process had just started. And we can talk about history, but here's the history as I understand it. There's never been a situation where you had a president of one party in the Senate of another, where the nominee, the replacement, was made in election years. It's been over 140 years ago. I think there have been 19 vacancies filled in election year. 17 of the 19 were confirmed to the court when the party of the president and the Senate were the same. In terms of timing, the hearing is starting 16 days after her nomination. More than half of all Supreme Court hearings have been held within 16 days of the announcement of the nominee. Stevens 10, Rehnquist 13, Powell 13, Blackmun 15, Berger 13. All I can say is that I feel that we're doing this constitutionally, that our Democratic friends object to the process. I respect them all. They'll have a chance to have their say. But most importantly, I hope we will know more about how the law works, checks and balances, what the Supreme Court is all about when this hearing is over. Why hold this hearing? A lot of people on our side say just ram it through. I hear that a lot. That's why I don't listen to the radio much anymore. So the bottom line is, I think it's important. This is a lifetime appointment. I would like the world and the country to know more about Judge Barrett. I'm proud of you. I'm proud of what you've accomplished. I think you're a great choice by the president. This is probably not about persuading each other unless something really dramatic happens. All Republicans will vote yes, and all Democrats will vote no. And that will be the way the breakout of the vote. But the hearing is a chance for Democrats to dig deep into her philosophy, appropriately ask her about the law. She would be different. What's on her mind? It gives Republicans a chance to do the same thing. Most importantly, it gives you a chance, the American people, to find out about Judge Barrett. Judge for yourself. Is this person qualified? Is she as qualified as Sotomayor and Kagan? I think so. These were two nominees presented to the committee by President Obama. They had a different legal philosophy than my own, but I never doubted one moment that they were not qualified. I thought Gorsuch and Kavanaugh were qualified. The Senate in the past has looked at qualifications more than anything else. We've taken a different path at times. Bork, Thomas, Alito, Kavanaugh. I hope we don't take that path with Judge Barrett. She doesn't deserve that. I don't think it makes this hearing any better. And the American people, I believe, would not deserve a repeat of those episodes and the Senate Judiciary Committee's history. To my Democratic colleagues, I respect you all. We've done some things together and we've had some fights in this committee. I've tried to give you the time you need to make your case, and you have every right in the world to make your case. I think I know how the vote's going to come out, but I think Judge Barrett is required for the good of the nation to submit to your questions and ours. This is going to be a long, contentious week. I would just ask one thing of the committee. To the extent possible, let's make it respectful. Let's make it challenging. Let's remember the world is watching.
Well, that's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham's opening statement this morning in the Senate Judiciary Committee for the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. What did you think about what Graham just said? And what do you think has changed between the days when justices like Antonin Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were easily confirmed to today, where these hearings are very contentious? We're going to go to the phones. People have been waiting patiently. I appreciate that. Let me give out the phone number in case you are waiting and you would like to call in. Here's the number, 813-239-9663. You can also text your thoughts to 813-433-0885 or email dj@wmnf.org. It's 12:47 in the afternoon. We're probably going to hear from Dick Durbin in just a few minutes, but let's hear right now from Andy in Dunedin. Andy, what's on your mind?
Hi, the road projects are on my mind. Can we speak to those quickly?
We can, yeah. Thanks for calling in about that.
I'm a Florida native of almost 60 years, born in Key West, raised in Brandon, lived in Jacksonville Beach for 20 years. I've been all over the state. This project is really, really unpopular, and I don't think the governor's going to give much ear to the will of the people as much as he will to the wealthy landowners. We've seen this happen before. The Suncoast Parkway comes to mind. They said it was going to have all this ridership, and it never came to fruition. They talk about having evacuation routes for hurricanes, but we know we've got tons of inland roads that never get used because people jump right on the interstate to take off. These are in highly sensitive areas, and we can't afford to lose any more of the wild areas that we have in Florida. The people that live in the rural areas are against it because they live in rural Florida for a reason, and that's not to be in the suburbs of the cities. It's a beautiful area. And they make promises to them for jobs, and all that equates to are gas stations and fast food restaurants at the interchanges. There are no needs for these roads. I travel the back roads all the time. There's plenty of them. They're beautiful, and they're not used as much as they possibly could be. So most Floridians are against this, but I don't know if the governor has an ear for them, so... we'll have to see. I mean, there's a similar project going through the north end of Starkey Wilderness Park just south of 52. And if you look that up, that's been going on for 20 years. It's been a battle, and nobody can seem to explain what that road even served. Thank you.
Andy, thanks so much for calling in. I appreciate those thoughts. And if you'd like to weigh in either on these MCOR highways, these proposed highways, or if you want to weigh in on the Supreme Court nominee, give us a call, 813-239-9663. Let me take another call before we hear from Dick Durbin, another caller too. Dan in St. Petersburg. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hello, thanks. These corridor projects with the interstate came up so fast, there wasn't time to think about it. I went to the first one in Tampa in August, and it wasn't handled correctly. So we got to hit the pause on that one. And this reparation stuff, there's some logic to it. I mean, it's right down there by Southside St. Pete. We need to get a lot of housing in there. There are opportunities to do, I'd like to see some 20-story buildings up around the interstate. But so many people think we can't build affordable housing in high-rises or mid-rises. It's got to be low stuff. And that's where the rub I have is that property is downtown core property. And I'd like to see a mixture of a lot of green space and high-rises. You know, a big accent to Booker Creek. So we got to figure out how to get everybody to live in a high-rise without starting whatever happens in there. So those are the two topics I got. Thank you.
All right, Dan, thanks so much for calling in, and I appreciate that call. And, of course, Dan is talking about the area around Tropicana Field, which will be redeveloped, presumably, if the Rays leave, if hopefully in a couple of weeks we'll be able to say if when the World Series champion Tampa Bay Rays leave the Tropicana Field, if that ever happens. The city wants to redevelop it. Our first guest was suggesting that that property be handed back to the Black community as part of reparations. So thanks for calling in, Dave. If you'd like to join this conversation, 813-239-9663. Before we hear from Senator Dick Durbin, let's hear from Rob in Thanota Sassa. Hi, Rob. What's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon, Sean.
Hi.
I have a couple of comments about the Barrett nomination. You know, I don't have any doubt that if you had a first-term Democratic president who was not looking to be to get reelected like Trump, and you had a Democrat-controlled Senate, and there was a chance to change the balance of the court, I have little doubt that a Democratic president would push through a nomination. I mean, I can't say I blame Trump. What I would also add to that is that I think that when you have a justice, and this is all due respect to, RBG, she knew she was battling a very virulent form of cancer, and she knew there was an election coming up. I think if you have a justice that's concerned about the balance of the court, maybe stepping down a year before the election or so would be a better thing to do to ensure that that seat remains that the court's balance is maintained. You know, I know they're lifetime appointments, but I don't think that's an unreasonable way of looking at it.
Yeah, I've heard that argument, and I've heard people criticize that argument, saying, here's the way I hear it said is that men are trying to tell women what to do when they say that. I'm not saying that that's what you're saying.
Oh, but, mansplaining, right?
Exactly. So, but what if she had? What if she had stepped down from the court 4 years ago or 5 years ago or 5.5 years ago, and Mitch McConnell had said, well, you know, now it's a 2-year rule or whatever. Who knows what would have happened? There's no guarantee that had Ruth Bader Ginsburg stepped down from the court during Obama's second term, that there would have been another confirmation hearing. Who knows what would have happened?
I mean, that's a reasonable argument, but I think that it would have been a lot less tolerable had there been a 2-year wait. You're not going to run the court for 2 years with 8 justices, you know. Really quickly on the reparations, I think it's a no problem with redevelopment and all that, but, you know, Rob had a guest on a few weeks ago. And this woman was naming a number like $43 trillion. I thought that was absurd. You know, in a time like now where you have a lot of divisiveness, if you want to drive people into the Republican camp, you know, or not there, I just think that's a bad idea.
All right. Thanks so much for weighing in on those issues, Rob, in Thanota Sassa. I appreciate that. If you'd like to call in, 813-239-9663. I got a partial text message here from Traveling Nurse. It says, I do not agree with, And it came in while Lindsey Graham was speaking, so maybe that's what Traveling Nurse was talking about, that Traveling Nurse doesn't agree with Lindsey Graham. We'll have to speculate there. All right, we may not get to hear from Dick Durbin, depending if people want to keep weighing in, which I hope they do. What do you think about these confirmation hearings? Let's go now to Barbara in Tampa. Hi, Barbara, you're on the air. What would you like to say?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to talk about MCORS. So thank you for having Lindsey Cross on. And I would say in addition that it's a real waste of dollars on a road that wasn't even on FDOT's plans. It was only put on their plans after Senator Galvano passed the bill, I guess because he told all the other senators they'd never have a bill heard unless they voted for it. And the governor signed it. Three previous governors said no, Bush, Crist, and Scott. And another reason because of the waste of dollars is that it would destroy so much agricultural land, environmental land, and wildlife connecting corridors. So thanks for letting me speak to that.
I appreciate you calling in, Barbara. Thanks so much for calling in. And if you'd like to join this conversation, 813-239-9663, or if you'd like to text 813-433-0885. We're going to go back to some sound from this morning right now. We heard earlier from Lindsey Graham, we heard his whole 10 minutes opening statement. We're going to hear part of what Dick Durbin said in the time remaining we have. Democrats, like Dick Durbin, stuck to their strategy and attempted to raise concerns that the Supreme Court could overturn the Affordable Care Act in a case that comes to the court just days after the election. And here's the opening part of the opening statement by Democrat Dick Durbin from Illinois.
Judge Barrett, your family, welcome. We're at a critical moment in our nation's history, in the throes of a devastating pandemic, with over 216,000 Americans dead and over 7.7 million infected with this virus. Each day we are reminded of how this invisible virus has changed our lives and changed America. And there is no end in sight. We face an economy in crisis with millions of jobs lost and crushing challenges facing workers, businesses, families all across America. And we're in the middle of election season. Millions of Americans have already cast their votes. And this may be one of the most consequential elections in our nation's history. Because for the first time in the history of the United States, an incumbent president refuses to commit to a peaceful transition of power if he loses the election. This president, in his vanity and constitutional recklessness, refuses to commit to accept the will of the American electorate. And of course, we're still in the process of mourning the loss of an historic champion of justice and equality, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg spent her entire life and every ounce of strength and talent she was given in the pursuit of America's highest ideal, equal justice under the law. Her absence is deeply felt. Now, this is the context in which the Senate Majority Republicans are defying the traditions of the Senate and rushing forward with President Trump's third nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court. It has been recounted earlier that Justice Ginsburg was approved by the Senate by a 96-3 vote. This icon of liberal thinking, advocate for the ACLU, 96-3 before the United States Senate, and then Anton Scalia on the opposite polar end of the political spectrum, approved 98-0. Amazing. Can this be the same Senate? It's not. The reason those votes were so overwhelming was because people live by the rules, they live by the traditions of the Senate, and they had mutual respect for one another. We know now that this process does not adhere to those guidelines. The haste in this pursuit that before us today is unfair to the Senate and unfair really to the nominee. The nominee before us was announced 16 days ago, the day after Justice Ginsburg lay in state in the United States Capitol. We received the nomination paperwork 13 days ago and have learned since then that some materials are missing. the speed with which Republicans are moving to fill this vacancy.
All right, well, that's part of Dick Durbin, Illinois Democratic Senator Dick Durbin's opening statement today during the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court. I want to thank everyone who called in and emailed and texted today. Thanks to Alvaro Montealegre for running the board. Thanks to Frank Knox for answering phones. I'm Sean Canaan, your host of WMNF's Midpoint Monday, tomorrow at noon. Your hero, Mark Bureau, will host Midpoint Tuesday. Stay tuned now for Latino 54. That's coming up after NPR headlines on WMNF Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks so much for listening.